Hello and welcome to another Future of Real Estate podcast. I'm Damien Wild. I've been excited about each and every episode of this podcast series so far, but at the risk of sounding like I'm picking a favourite child, this is perhaps my favourite. Today I'm joined on the line by Bruce Daisley, podcaster, author and all-round authority on the future of work. Bruce is, of course, the head of Twitter in Europe as well. It's a fascinating discussion. On it, Bruce talks about the failure of open plan offices, the cultural toxicity of some tech workplaces, his thoughts on WeWork and other flexible workspace providers are available, of course. He talks about email guilt, and he talks about why he isn't at all optimistic about the future of work. It's a more uplifting listen than that implies. Trust me on that, but it's an important one. Here's Bruce. Bruce Daisley is the host of Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat, an Apple number one business podcast on happiness and work culture. He's also the author of the new book, The Joy of Work, the Sunday Times number one best-selling book in January, no less. And somehow he combines all of this with running Twitter across Europe. Bruce, congratulations.
Hello there. Makes it sound good when you describe it like that.
Oh, well, very well deserved. It's a great book. I've enjoyed it very much. And this all started with the belief drawn from personal experience that the workplace is dysfunctional.
Yeah, I think what it started with the belief was that I'd observed workplaces that I'd been in that had been really good places to work, and then places that maybe felt less energized. And I was just interested in trying to understand, was there any science behind that? It just seemed like an accident. You know, you joined a new company. Sometimes it felt incredible and energizing. Sometimes it felt like things weren't quite clicking. And I was just interested in what the science was of that, really, what the evidence was for it.
Okay. And did you anticipate it would be relevant to so many people? Or was this really a sort of personal crusade to improve the workplaces you were in?
Yeah, I mean, look, it was Sunday Times number one business book last month. So I certainly hadn't expected that. I think, you know, here's what happened. I started being interested. I searched Amazon for books on improving work and worker culture, and I was actually disappointed with what was there. And I only started my podcast from there, really, thinking, oh right, as no one answered this question, then I'll do. I listened to a lot of podcasts myself, and I thought, oh, I'll do a sort of series of six podcasts. Maybe if I do a series of six, a few experts will agree to talk to me, and I can get, hopefully I can sort of get a body of evidence of how to improve work. And I started doing the process, and the podcast became sort of a success way beyond what I'd expected, really. And from there, I just thought, you know, Penguin actually approached me saying, would you turn it into a book? And I thought, you know what, I've sort of gathered enough evidence here that I think I probably could make a book out of this. So none of it was ever intended. It's all sort of developed as it went along, really.
Okay, so perhaps relevant to more people than you expected. That's a bit frightening and depressing, isn't it? That we're all trying to establish joy at work, but we're failing more often than we're succeeding, it feels like.
Yeah, and look, you know, a lot of people might contest, is it sort of rightful to want to enjoy work? Is it rightful to sort of to be seeking out pleasure at work? But I think, you know, the critical thing for me is that I was interested in how we could drive motivation. Look, you know, here's the reality of modern work. The reality of modern work is that half of all office workers say they feel burnt out, where they sort of don't have the energy to get things done. And it often impacts their private life rather than their personal life, but they just feel exhausted. In fact, I read an article this week, because there's been so many comments on this recently, the article this week saying maybe 2019 is the year of burnout, you know, because we're just reading so much about it. And I think that was definitely my experience, that I was personally exhausted. People I worked with were exhausted. And so I was, it just really struck me that, you know, that this was going on, and I just wanted to see what the evidence was to try and turn it around, really.
Well, there's been so much talk of mental health issues in the workplace, yeah, and outside of the workplace, so that really resonates. There was a phrase that really stuck out for me, actually, that overlaps with that, about how the smartphone has stretched the working week. We no longer switch off when we leave the office, which has upsides as well as downsides, of course. But it means that, I think this was Linda Stone from Microsoft used this phrase, it means that we're in a state of continuous partial attention.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the issue with that is that there's something called attention residue. So we might think that we're switching between two things. We might think that we're doing emails and watching TV. But I think anyone who's found themselves doing emails and watching TV will recognize you're not fully following the plot. And the reason why things pass you by is that switching between things is imperfect. We sort of have this attention residue. And the challenge of that is that you find, number one, when people don't give their full attention to things, it appears that they're less happy from the activities they're doing. So, you know, you enjoy TV shows much more if you watch them uninterrupted. You know, that's what the sort of scientists measure. The second thing is that it seems to take us much longer to do them. So switching between two things, you know, we might be writing a document, but also keeping an eye on our email. And what you find is that if you dedicate your undivided attention to making that document, you get it done a lot quicker. And so this works sort of the lie we tell ourselves, really. We think we can do two things at once, but actually, the evidence suggests that all we're doing is just prolonging the amount of time we're spending on the tasks we're doing.
And so we should go into monk mode so often, which was a phrase that was new to me. Is that one you coined?
Yes. Yeah, so monk mode morning is this notion that a few people have stumbled upon, is that, you know, maybe a couple of times a week, that, you know, you maybe have 90 minutes of uninterrupted work. Maybe you don't come into the office first thing that day, you get that document done that you're trying to get done. It's almost like you schedule it like you would schedule a meeting. And you find that by just immersing yourself in that deep work, you get more done. So I think, you know, it's a big opportunity for us to try and just improve the way that we're getting things done. We're achieving better concentration, really.
So that's one of the lies that we tell ourselves, that we're great at multitasking. Another is that we respond well to pressure. And, you know, given a deadline and, you know, that intense, feverish work means we do our best work. But that's not a recipe for creativity, is it?
Yeah, and I think that's the number one. This is the number one issue that's facing all of us. You know, half of all people who check emails 2 hours a day outside of working hours. So that's most of us, right? Let's be honest, that's most of us. We show the highest measurable levels of stress. So, you know, half of us are in this cortisol-drenched state of anxiety and stress. And I think we can all recognize that to some extent. You know, if the first thing that you say to people when they ask you how you are, you say busy, then you're probably in more of a stress state than you'd readily admit. And here's the thing. What we've found is that while a tiny amount of pressure can make us more productive, actually when we're at those excessive levels of pressure, it acts to be at the expense of our creativity. So it means that we don't have the freeness of thinking, we don't have the sort of the looseness of thought, we don't connect ideas. In fact, when you look at when people really have their ideas, it's not when they're sort of stressed staring into their laptop screens. It's when they're often in a distractible daydreaming state. Sometimes it's what neuroscientists call the default mode or the default network. It's where we're very loosely engaged. In fact, my favorite example of this, a lot of people say that they have their best ideas when they're staring out the window of a car or they're in the shower. My favorite example of this is the guy who wrote the West Wing TV show. He wrote the Social Network, a guy called Aaron Sorkin. He said he has his best ideas in the shower. And so he installed a shower in his office. He says he has 8 to 10 showers a day. So, you know, I think when we think about, when we're honest about what the inputs of creativity are, we come to very different conclusions than when we sort of follow the easy habits that we've got into.
We'll come on to the workplace in a moment, and you know, perhaps focusing on installing more showers in the workplace would make us more creative and productive. But some of the things you talk about, and you identify 30 ways to fix a broken work culture. Some are team orientated, some are individually orientated, and some relate to the workplace, and then some are much more personal, like sleep, laugh, take a digital Sabbath. So perhaps more of this is in our control than we like to think.
Yeah, I think that was my take. So, look, you know, it might be strange for a book on workplace culture, and the book is resolutely about how to improve the culture at your work. It might be strange for it to start with these 12 interventions to how to feel better yourself. And that's because what happened was that I started looking into this. And a good example of is what I see when I quite often, you know, people approach me, a charity approached me recently and said, we tried to change our culture and we invited people along to a 3-hour meeting and everyone declined the meeting. And I thought, that's exactly what
we've all done that, haven't we?
Yeah. We're all in the zone where we want to get to somewhere, but we don't know how to get there. And the thing that's presenting itself to us in the meantime is that we all feel a little bit burnt out by the volume of emails we have. You know, the average British person has 16 hours a week of meetings. And so the default state, the place we find ourselves in, is we feel like we're treading water, we're getting nothing done. And so I wanted to say, were there some personal interventions that we could make that would make work feel less overwhelming personally on us? So then when we set about changing workplace culture, we feel a bit more energized to do it.
Okay. And this isn't a book on diversity, but you do touch on diversity and the dangers of groupthink. And I guess if we are going to introduce these 30 changes and turn that culture around, you know, we need to have much, you know, we need to think in different ways and have a much more diverse workplace than some workplaces are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, you know, the interesting thing about diversity is that it's the reason why there's a chapter on diversity in there is because there's a pitfall about team culture that quite often people say things like, you know what, he was the sort of guy you'd want to go for a beer with, or, you know what, we hire people who are just a good culture fit. And the danger of that is that what you often do, when you look at the science of diversity is pretty well proven that when you've got a plurality of opinions, people seem to make better decisions. And what you find is that, but when you put people into diverse groups, they can often say it didn't feel as comfortable. And I think as soon as you're forewarned and forearmed about that, then at least you can be aware. So, like, if you're looking for just something that's going to feel easy all the time, you'll probably choose something that's got sort of cultural homogeneity, people who look the same. You know, if you just hire people who are into cricket, you know, I can pretty much guarantee they're going to have a great time hanging around together. But it doesn't mean it's a very rounded group of individuals. So you just need to, I think the reason why I put the diversity thing in there is just it's a wake-up call. When people are thinking about culture, they can, if they're not careful, find themselves going into sort of cultural cul-de-sac where they're hiring people that don't necessarily add a plurality of opinion.
Yeah, that's certainly something real estate is wrestling with at the moment and making some positive steps. But these things are never as quick as we'd like. So the workplace, and there are a couple of references in the book to the workplace, and I'd be interested in your thoughts more broadly. One was where you talk about Twitter's first office in London, a rickety serviced office on Great Titchfield Street, where the head of sales, now UKMD, Dara Nazur, chose a desk space so bad he couldn't type while sitting down. Was that an impediment to effectiveness?
No, I mean, look, you know, that was deliberate. Like, we were sort of... you know, it was like it was a very much a startup. We were, you know, far smaller than the outside world might have projected. And, you know, we had initially a handful of people, then maybe sort of 30 people. And, you know, Dara chose the worst desk in the office because he chose the worst desk in the office largely because he thought if he chose the worst desk, no one could complain if they didn't get a window seat. So it was just sort of cultural. You know, it's just like, I think, servant leadership, really.
Yeah.
Sort of demonstrating that, look, you know, we're not in palatial surroundings and none of us should feel like that, you know, that despite that, we want to get higher up the pecking order ourselves. So it was just good behavior on his behalf, really.
So an aesthetically bad workplace can be a positive, depending where the company is on its life.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think one of the issues that probably we've got with regards to the modern workplace is they're constructed too much for aesthetics and too little for utility. So, you know, certainly when we look at the modern workplace, something that photographs well, a beautiful open plan office with big windows, seems to be the enemy of productivity. And know what will happen when I say this to workforce people, they say, oh, no. Actually, open plan is proven to be good. It's bad working practices. And that is literally like, it's just a force of nonsense because, you know, you can't say that the use of open plan offices is bad, but the design is good if everyone is using them bad. You know, like it's like saying, oh, I don't want to encumber myself with a bad metaphor, but you know, if something is being continuously used badly, then it's badly designed.
Okay, what does Twitter's workplace look like today?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, so like everyone in the whole world, we followed the advice of the experts and we went to open plan. And so so we do have an open plan office. The one thing that we've learned as the time has gone on, I mean, it's a much more nicely appointed office than we started off in. It's a beautiful place. But what we've done over the last few years is make edits and adjustments to add suitably quiet spaces. So we've tried to add, you know, phone booths and a library space, and tried to give people space to escape, really.
Okay. There was another workplace reference which I enjoyed. It was a quote, and I'll read out a couple of paragraphs in the book. It was from renowned ad man Rory Sutherland, who said, "We shouldn't even come into the office to do emails. We should only come to work to have conversations and meet people." He says, "In the former life of the office, you had to come into work to make a photocopy. You had to come into work to produce a document, to produce a presentation, send a telex, that dates it, even to make an international phone call. You basically came into the office to do it because it cost £29 and you didn't want that on your unitemized phone bill." It has changed a lot, hasn't it? And he goes on to say, "Now 90% of what an office used to be for is just as available at home, assuming you have reasonable broadband. So you have to ask the question, what is the office for now? You should be meeting people by pre-arrangement or meeting people by accident. And the problem I always notice," he says, "is that when you're doing email, you're not meeting people by accident because it's fundamentally antisocial behaviour." So that brings together some of what you've been saying about, I guess, monk mode, and also about open plan offices. There's a tension between those two, isn't there? How do you square that circle?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's the conundrum of modern work, that we find the conundrum of modern work is that we find ourselves in this situation where, you know, there's no simple answer that we can easily reach for. And I think the thing that we're finding now is that when you look at the evidence, it appears that you need a combination of the two different things. You need a combination of people able to immerse themselves in periods of concentration and a period where they get together and maybe exchange thoughts on those things. And they're two separate entities. And it definitely was the idea of open plan offices. I think, you know, open plan offices was a good experiment, but open plan offices have mainly been proven to sort of increase the volume of email and reduce the day-to-day conversation, really. So I think, you know, trying to get a balance where people can get some intense deep work done, but then go and have sort of more discursive interactions with colleagues seems to be the best thing.
And where does WeWork and their peers sit in all of this? Are we moving to a much more, in terms of establishing joy in work, is a flexible workspace more joyous, frequent movement more joyous?
The one thing I'm interested in with flexible workspaces is, you know, clearly the people who use WeWork very often have got a high degree of satisfaction with them. The one thing that I have observed is that quite often people in WeWork spaces lose some of their own cultural identity. So, you know, the Prosecco and beer on tap that's shared across the whole building means that people quite often socialize with other members of the building rather than their members of their company. So there does appear to be an impact to it. I think we're only just learning to see it. But I think broadly overall, people's people often take a good degree of pride from the workspace that they're in, and being in WeWork certainly seems to contribute to that.
Okay, and do you see some sectors being better than others? Does tech get it right more often than financial services, for instance? Have you gone that far in your analysis?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, I think one of the dangers that we've got at the moment is there's been so much misdirection by the tech sector, so much sort of peacocking of their cultures, really, that I think this we've potentially, there's the danger that we've been misdirected. So, you know, while I've been immensely fortunate, I love working at Twitter, and it's sort of been an incredible cultural environment to be in. But I definitely know that there are other parts of the tech sector that hide often quite toxic cultures behind the guise of being well-loved consumer products.
Okay. When you say toxic, what do you mean by toxic?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, I don't want to name names, but there are organisations whose operating system seems to be stress and insecurity. And, you know, there's some quite famous tech firms who make a point of saying, you know, we feel very comfortable paying people to leave if they don't achieve the very best results. And I think, you know, one of the ways that you describe that is it's something called psychological safety. And I think, you know, finding an absence of psychological safety because you're scared that you're going to be fired, I think it's a significant threat to a lot of people.
Okay. And we should wrap up. I just wonder, where, as you look forward, are we moving in the right direction? Will we be in a better place in 5 years' time? Is there a perfect place?
Yeah, I think it's real bifurcation. So, like, I think some places will get better and most places will get way, way worse. So I'm not optimistic at all. I think, you know, the lesson of the last few years is that we've taken work and we've just added more and more to it. So we've added more emails, we've added more you know, more meetings. And that's why everyone is increasingly feeling exhausted and burnt out. I think, you know, that's the lesson. I can't see it changing in the short term. So I'm not an optimist, but I think some workplaces will get better. And sort of that's why I wrote the book, really. The sort of the joy of work was the intention of trying to, I'd found there was loads of evidence, and I wanted to share that evidence with other people.
I think you're right. There's not much displacement when it comes to meetings or emails. It can always feel additional.
Yeah, and the reason why a lot of us, you know, the average state for most of us is we go home at the end of the day feeling guilty. And we feel guilty because we haven't got to the bottom of our inbox. We feel guilty because we, we didn't get back to that guy. We feel guilty because someone looked over while we were on our phone in a meeting. You know, we feel we're in a state of continuous guilt. And so, you know, I think that's going to require progressive leadership, I think, to change.
And do you practice what you preach? Have you implemented all 30 ways to fix your culture?
Yeah, I mean, look, and I think the important thing to say is that, you know, one of the things in there is you take a lunch break. And I don't beat myself up if I don't take a lunch break every day. But it's in my head where I say, look, you know, make sure you take 2 or 3 lunch breaks this week. And especially when the weather's nicer, I make a point of, right, go to the park and read your book, or, you know, go and meet someone. And I try and do those things. And, look, you know, that's the interesting thing, that very few people would say taking a lunch break is on the roadmap to improving work culture. But actually what you find is it acts in service of making us feel less overwhelmed by work. Therefore, we get into a state of something called positive effect. We get into a more sort of expansive mind state. And it acts in service of making our workplace better.
Well, fantastic. And the podcast will continue. Will there be another book, rather?
I've only just got this book out. So
sounds like we need another 30 ways to fix things already.
It's a bit like asking a woman who's just given birth if she fancies having another baby. That's me in a year.
Well, I'll come back. Well, I think you're speaking at one of our events on the future of Manchester, I think in end of June, early July. So I'll ask you there. I'll save it for there.
Yeah, good.
Okay, Bruce, thanks a lot and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
So a slightly bleak end there, but do remember, this is within our control by and large, so let's influence it. And overall, I couldn't recommend Bruce's book more highly. If you're interested in the potential for joy at work, the future of work, or indeed the future of the workplace, and surely that's every one of us. See you next time for another Future of Real Estate podcast.